The turf at the Super Bowl may be artificial this year, but there will be at least one very excited horticulturist in training on the sidelines. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. I'll talk with Kevin Hansen, a senior in horticulture at Iowa State University, about his turf management internship at the Super Bowl. Then horticulturists Richard Duran and Cindy Haynes will be here. Cindy has just gotten back from the U.S. Virgin Islands, where she's been working on a school garden project. We'll talk about that, and she and Richard will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Super Bowl 47 takes place on February 3rd, a horticulture student from Iowa State University will be there on the sidelines. Kevin Hansen has been selected for the Toro Super Bowl Sports Turf Training Program and will be spending 7 days in New Orleans getting ready for the big game. Hello, Kevin.
How you doing?
Great. And this is a big honor. How many people are selected to be part of this training program?
I am the only one as far as I know.
And what will it actually involve?
Well, like you said, I'll be down there for 7 days. And we're just getting everything prepared for the Super Bowl, though, on the field anyways. That'll be we have the main field. And then there's there's two other practice fields that we'll have to set up and get ready for the teams.
And so, of course, you're not starting from ground zero at this point, presumably. You're not actually seeding the field. What will you be doing to get the field ready?
Well, it's in New Orleans this year, and they have an artificial field, which makes it a little bit easier. I'm usually used to working on natural fields. But mostly, I think what we'll be doing is it'll be a lot of painting the field, the logos and all the lines on both the main field and the two practice fields.
You were selected for this program because of a 500-word essay that you wrote. What did you write about?
Well, we had to kind of give our work experience and kind of why we felt like we should be chosen, or I should be chosen for this. And I give a lot of credit to the people that I work with. And I had to get 2 recommendations also for the application. And I think those played a big role in why I was selected too.
And you are a horticulture student at Iowa State University, and you're focusing on turf management?
Yep, specific sports turf management.
What drew you to that field?
Well, it kind of started off, my mom made me get a job when I was a junior in high school, and she kind of hooked me up with a job at a golf course, is where it all started. And I found out quickly that maybe golf course wasn't really for me. And the next summer, she lined me up at Jack Trice Stadium, and I pretty much fell in love with it from there.
Really? And your mom has a horticulture background too, right?
Yep, she does. Both my parents are in the ag world. They both graduated from Iowa State and started off as FFA teachers, so they kind of pushed me in the right direction.
So the difference between a golf course and a natural turf football stadium, from my perspective, it's grass.
Right,
what was it about Jack Trice Stadium and working on the turf there that really made you fall in love with this field?
It's just sports. I grew up sports. I played a lot of sports in high school, and I think it's just the big payoff is game day when you got thousands of fans sitting around just pretty much staring at what you've been working on all summer, all year long.
You have had some other jobs in this field over the years. You've worked with the iCubs. What do you do with them?
I did 2 internships with them, actually. One I did with the actual iCubs, the baseball team, working on their field, getting that ready for batting practice or the game or the 7th inning stretch when we have to pull the drags. And I did another summer with them. They also have an outsourcing company that they do off the side, and they build and maintain sports complexes and fields for local high schools, colleges, all sorts of, from Little League on up.
So is baseball work as exciting to you as football?
Baseball is a lot of fun, too. It's they just have a lot more hours. There's a ton of baseball games in a season, so it starts to wear on you a little more.
And then you landed an internship, a three-month internship with the Green Bay Packers. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was definitely a turning point in my career so far. I was lucky enough to get selected for that and went up there, and they have quite a few fields, including Lambeau and some practice fields and an indoor field. And they really took me under their wing and showed me the ropes and what it was like to work on a level like that. And it was all around great experience, and I loved it down there.
What do you do on a daily basis when you're tending to a natural turf football field?
That's probably why I love the job the most, because day to day you're gonna do something different every day, whether it's fertilizing, whether it's mowing, whether it's aerating. You know, you get to do a wide variety of things, and I think that's why it keeps me coming back.
In reading about what you're going to be doing in New Orleans, I read that you'll be working alongside consultant George Toma, and he has helped prepare every field for the Super Bowl in the history of the game.
Yeah, he has been around for a long time, and I think that's one of the biggest things I'm looking forward to with this whole Super Bowl thing, is just meeting the people that are there, because they're some of the leaders in my industry, and I plan on doing, or try to do, a lot of networking while I'm up there, just set me up for things to come in the future.
What are you most excited about with the Super Bowl?
Oh, I'm just excited to see what the atmosphere is, because I've been in college football. I mean, that's a blast. It still gives me goosebumps, and I can't imagine being on the biggest stage in football, let alone being right there on the sidelines for it. It still hasn't even sunk in yet.
And you will get to be there right on the sidelines, right?
Yep, that's what I'm told, so.
Oh, that's awesome.
I hope that's what happens, yeah.
And you talked about how the payoff is on game day when everybody's staring at the work you've done, but I think a lot of people take the field for granted. Does that bother you?
Well, I guess I'm not really in it for the gratitude. It's more just a personal accomplishment. And we do get recognized now and then. Like, just this past month, we got Field of the Year at Iowa State. So that's a big achievement for us and our crew at Iowa State.
Field of the Year from who?
From STMA. It's Sports Turf Managers Association. And it's an organization that pretty much oversees everything sports turf. And that's where I'm at right now. I'm actually sitting on the beach in Florida at the STMA conference.
Tough gig. So,
yeah, it's pretty nice.
What do you think makes the field at Jack Trice Stadium the field of the year? What makes it special?
I really think it's the crew and our boss, Tim Van Loo. This is his third year here. He's a great guy, and the crew that we have right now are just really hardworking, and they have a passion for what we're doing. And it shows from the field.
With the Super Bowl coming up, you're going to be doing a whole lot of painting, I guess, when you get there. You're going to be working on these practice fields as well. Do you know how much you'll actually get to see the teams as they get ready for the game?
We usually try to stay away from for the most part, kind of not to make a big deal or anything, because you kind of try to act like you've been there, you know.
Are you a Destiny's Child fan?
No, not too fond.
So it's not the halftime show that's going to be your highlight.
I think Beyonce is going to be there, isn't she?
Right, she's reuniting with Destiny's Child.
Yeah, that's going to be a blast. I don't know if I'll have to do anything for the halftime show, but I'm sure I'll be able to watch it.
They'll probably mess up your turf.
Yeah. I don't know.
So, Kevin, you graduate in May. What's next for you?
You know, I'm not exactly sure what my future is after this next semester. I'll probably apply for some jobs. You know, it's kind of scary, but I think that's how it goes.
And what are you hoping for the future? What would be your dream job?
I really like what I did in the NFL, and I'm really happy with the college, too. So either one of those, if I could work for a university or somehow get into the NFL, I mean, I would be sitting pretty there.
Well, you'll certainly have a nice highlight on your resume.
Yeah, that's been the plan since day one. Gotta get me set up for something good.
Well, congratulations, Kevin.
Oh, thank you.
I was talking with Kevin Hansen. He's a senior in horticulture at Iowa State University, and that, of course, is Destiny's Child. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me now, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
And since Kevin made me feel old by not knowing who Destiny's Child was, and then I made you feel older.
I didn't either.
I thought I'd play a little bit for you. Cindy Haynes is also here with us today. She's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning. And I can't believe he doesn't want to see Destiny's Child. That'd be good.
He'll see them anyway.
He will.
Maybe he'll be a fan after.
He
after
will.
The fact. Well, we, of course, will get to the phones in a few minutes. If you have questions for Richard and Cindy, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I was just talking to Kevin from the beach in Florida. And Cindy, you just got back from the Virgin Islands, right?
Right. I just took two students, Iowa State students, to intern at St. John at a school there as part of an EARTH program that we have as partnership with Iowa State and a high school in St. John.
And this is a program that's been going on now since 2010, so you're 2.5 years into the program?
Right. It's our third, starting of our third year into the program, and we have, like I said, we've always had these students, at least two students that go down per semester, and they work with middle school students there and teach them about horticulture and plants and everything involved in that. And of course, the plant palette's very different in St. John than it is in Iowa.
I'm sure that it is. And the weather was probably a little different as well.
Yes. Yes. It was really nice and warm. It was 80 degrees there when I was there last week.
So. Oh, nice. Well, mm-hmm. We will talk more about the school gardening service learning program of Iowa State University in the Virgin Islands in just a moment. And also, Richard and Cindy are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Richard Geron from Iowa State University Extension and Cindy Haynes, an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And before we dive into questions, Cindy, before the break, we teased this just a little bit, mm-hmm. that you just got back from the Virgin Islands, where you were taking students down for the school garden service learning program that you call EARTH, mm-hmm. Education and Resiliency Through Horticulture, that's been going on for a couple of years now. So at the beginning of your third year of this program, what's your take on it? How have things been going?
Oh, I think it's been going incredibly well. I can see the impact on the kids at the school. So, you know, anywhere from these kind of sixth graders to eighth graders, which we're focusing on now, to the high school students who were, you know, the sixth and the eighth graders just a couple of years ago, seeing them want to grow more and grow more at their home and learning more about horticulture, about plants, about biology. And they're even starting this kind of culinary arts program or culinary science program so that they take the produce that they're creating and make meals with it. So, and fantastic things they're making.
Do you get to spend enough time down there that you really get to know some of the students?
I did this past week. I spent a week in what they call a mini-mester, where we all worked with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders at a farm, harvesting stuff and then making and cooking things. And then they had a big taster at the end of the week where they made, you know, these elaborate appetizers or little passion fruit creme brulees and, you know, all these kind of different wonderful things for a group of donors or people for the school. So I got to spend a lot of time with the 6th, 7th, and 8th graders that I feel like I know them pretty well, which was nice.
Can you give me a couple of examples of how you've seen this experience affecting one or two of the kids?
Right. Well, we've heard from one or two of the kids that one of them in particular wants to be a botanist or horticulturist. So she's in high school. She's a junior in high school, and this is what she's thinking about as a career. With a couple of the other kids, the Virgin Islands, there's some incredibly wealthy people. There's also some incredibly poor people. And some of the kids that are coming from the not-so-advantaged household, they're telling me, oh, I can cook this for my family. I know where to get these kind of local foods now. And they talk about these experiences of growing some of these plants and making meals and what they've learned from, you know, the Earth program or the classes related to that and how they'll use it in the future. So they do a really good job of letting us know how it impacts them.
I know you're a big proponent of school gardens anywhere. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you're learning things and that people with Iowa State are learning things that can be brought back to Iowa and schools here in spite of the fact that we don't have school during the growing season for the most part?
I do think we do. And that is the advantage they have is that they're growing things that can be grown during the school year. But some of those same concepts, even growing things in, you know, indoors, are easy enough to bring back and do anywhere. And to see, like I said, to use that produce or whatever you're harvesting in some sort of school lunch program or even at home cooking and just trying and tasting different things, then we're promoting better health and well-being for everyone.
All right. Well, let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with the questions that you have about the plants in your life. Jim is on the line first. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you. I bought some property up here in northeast Iowa, and I have a fence line along the road that has a lot of ditch weeds and trees and things like that, and I was just wondering if I'd like to plant some wildflowers or prairie grass and how I would prepare that for planting. And if you have any suggestions on what to plant, it'd be hard to till it because of the steepness of the ditch. So I was wondering if I should burn it off or what. So that's my question.
So, and how much land did you buy, Jim?
I bought about 60 acres.
Wow.
Okay.
The frontage on the road is only about a quarter of a mile. So that's what I wanted to clean up.
Okay.
If they're small trees, let's say maybe 4 or 5 foot trees, burning it might destroy the trees. If they're bigger trees, what you may have to do is maybe cut them down in the spring and then apply Roundup to the cut surface.
Okay.
So
they're actually pretty small trees,
okay.
Actually. So.
Okay. So maybe burning might be sufficient. The thing is, though, that you need to destroy the grasses and the other vegetation somehow. And one way of doing that is with Roundup, where you just go out there and apply Roundup to the area. So if you were to burn it, then you'd have to wait until the grasses and plants grew back, and then apply your Roundup and kill that vegetation. And then I would find a local source for some native wildflower and grass seed.
Okay, yeah.
And typically you're going to have to somehow get the seed into the soil. So you may need some type of drill or some device to get that seed into the soil.
Will dragging it do after I go over? How long after the Roundup do I do this?
Well, it's probably going to take, I would guess, at least a couple weeks or so for the sprayed vegetation to die back. And if you have some areas, let's say you have some really difficult to control plants, you may have to come back and spray a second time possibly. So this could take some time. You might want to check locally, possibly your local county conservation board. They might know of a local source as far as maybe some type of drill or some other implement that you could maybe borrow or use and go from there.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. And Jim, before you go, Richard, we talked about this recently, but what are some of the resources that you can turn to? Because we have a lot of people in Iowa that would be willing to help Jim out.
Well, there's the Iowa Prairie Network. They have a web page and they have some information there. And I think they have sources of local or native wildflower and grass seed, so you can try there. Your county conservation board, I think the DOT might have some information on their web page. So there's quite a bit of information out there.
All right, Jim, good luck.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for your call, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question on email from Josh in Iowa City. He said, this fall, I dug up my rosemary and brought it indoors. It has a southern window, and I water it about once a week, but it is now dried, curled, and looks nearly dead. Can I revive it? I tried giving it a soaking last week, and I think it got worse. Should I have simply left it outdoors?
No, leaving it outdoors, it would not survive. It's not a reliably hardy perennial. Rosemary is tough. I always have a problem with rosemary. It likes that consistency, so it doesn't like to be too dry. It doesn't like to be too wet. And it can very quickly dry out. So he did the right thing when it started to dry out into watering it again. My guess is maybe the tips of it will start to die, and maybe there was some root death because of that. And the important thing is not to let it stay too wet at this point, because it'll have some more root rot. So it may come back a little bit. It may also mean that this is just a plant you're going to have to repurchase or buy again year after year.
They are very finicky. You can try bringing them inside, and sometimes it works, and other times they die completely. So it's very difficult.
I had one for a couple of years in a pot, and it was great for two winters indoors, and then the third winter it just, you know, it didn't manage to make it, and I was doing all the same things. So it has a mind of its own, rosemary.
All right. Mm-hmm. And he also asks, which herbs do well indoors?
Oh, you can grow basil very easily indoors, and it grows really quickly, so you can have something to harvest. Chives, thyme are some things you can grow in pots indoors as well. Parsley and even cilantro will grow well in containers indoors too. So there's quite a few other options that you could try indoors.
You could probably devote a whole room of your house to that, it sounds like.
Yeah, you could. You could have your own little, I like those little windowsill herb gardens that you can do indoors, and you can have a selection of two or three things.
And if you were growing all of these things inside, what kind of light exposure would they need? Would it have to be a southern window?
Herbs do best if they get as much light as possible. So a southern or a western window is considered ideal, so that they're getting some direct light. You get better tasting herbs that way.
And with a grow light, would you also have
sure.
success?
Sure. It could be really well, very close to the grow light, and make sure it's on for at least 12 to 14 hours a day, so you get that kind of long day.
All right. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Judy is on the line next from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Yes. I just wanted to let you know that, I don't know whether you know this or not, but here in Cedar Rapids, they're taking a proactive measure to keep out the ash borer, the emerald ash borer. And just in my neighborhood, in the last 2 weeks, they have cut down 25 ash trees. And the city is doing that. So I just wonder if you're aware of that. And
well, I hadn't heard about that particular program, but I have heard about it happening in a lot of towns around Iowa. In fact, on Iowa State University's
right.
campus, they've
right.
also been cutting down ash trees, right?
Okay. Well, it's just kind of a shame, but I guess we have to do it, right?
Well, they're doing it probably because, like on the Iowa State University campus, there's several thousand ash trees.
Well, maybe not several thousand. I think there's like 1 or 2,000 maybe.
Right. But and they're trying to, you know, reduce the amount that they're going to have to cut in the future and taking out those that might be as not as healthy as others.
Right.
So, okay. Well, I just want to know if you knew about that. And I was gone for several weeks and came home and they were cutting down trees.
Yeah, and they often do it during the holiday season when there's maybe fewer people around. So, but we're still not recommending that homeowners do this, because homeowners generally don't have 1,000 ash trees to worry about.
Okay,
but well, is the idea that. Of this
okay, well, thank
that?
Thank you so much for the.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your call, Judy. Is the idea of this that if we take out ash trees now, then we have an opportunity to actually plant trees to have a greater diversity?
We can space it out, removing the trees, so it doesn't become a
huge,
big economic burden. And if
and
we
a
do
huge blight on the landscape as well. I lived through the emerald ash borer invasion in Michigan, and it was just heartbreaking.
So that's their plan. And the good news is that the insect is still located only in a single area in Iowa, a single county. So it does travel very slowly by itself. So if humans don't intervene, we'll have plenty of time to do these things.
All right. Let's get to Paul from Audubon next. Hi, Paul.
Yes.
Hi, what's your question?
I have ants in my bathroom. And I'm trying to figure out where they're coming from, and I've caulked most of the cracks. And these are very lethargic ants. They'll sit in one place for several minutes, and then they'll move slowly. If you disturb them, they'll run. They're black. Can they possibly live in the air ducts with the blast of cold air in the winter, in the summertime from the air conditioner and the furnace in the wintertime?
So are they black in color?
They're black.
Are they fairly large?
I'd say they're medium-sized.
Okay. My first guess, I'm not an entomologist, but my first guess would be they're carpenter ants. And if you see carpenter ants at this time of year, then most likely they have their colony or nest somewhere in rotting wood within the house, because they make their home basically naturally in dead logs outside, in tree cavities where you have rotting wood. That's where they typically make their nest. And
well,
those
carpenter ants are relatively large, though, aren't they?
They are. I would suspect that's what they are, that they're probably carpenter ants. What you can do, which I would suggest doing, is maybe catching two or three of these ants, putting them in a small little vial, bring them down to the county extension office in Audubon, and request they send that to our insectary building on campus.
Okay.
Specifically to Donald Lewis here at Iowa State.
Okay.
And he can identify those and get back to you. But that would be my first thought, that they're carpenter ants, because if they are carpenter ants and you see them, then they obviously have to be indoors somewhere. Otherwise, the ones outdoors are not active. It's too cold. But if they're somewhere in the house, let's say you have a rotting board maybe near a door or a window, and they make their home there, then it's warm enough where they would be active during the winter months. If they were outside, they wouldn't be. So that's why I'm guessing probably carpenter ants.
Okay.
And they can be very, very hard to locate as far as that, the actual nest, because it could be inside underneath a wall or whatever, and very, very hard to locate.
Okay. I'll do that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Paul. Good luck with that.
Okay.
And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Diane is on the line in Vinton. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I just have a comment for the lady who is enduring the shock of the ash trees gone in CR, and I can totally identify with that. But another way to look at that is the towns right now, because of no snow, they have labor available to take care of, to take these trees down. And they're not having to pay these guys overtime.
it's probably a good time of year to do it.
19 million trees are dead all at once. You know, what are they going to do with them all at once? And they're going to have to hire an awful lot of people with overtime, and it's going to be extra expensive. And another angle on it is now they can go ahead and plant trees that are of a variety of species and get those started.
Diane, thanks a lot for your perspective on that. And also, Richard, if they're taking the trees out right now, mm-hmm. I'm guessing that it's easier to dispose of the wood. When you're taking down infected trees, there are different procedures that you have to pursue. I think you have to make sure to chip that wood mm-hmm. into mm-hmm. pieces that are smaller than 2 inches.
Right.
And if the trees aren't infected, that's not a concern, right?
No. And that's what they're doing here on campus is they're taking them down and they're being chipped. So
they're
going to be used. They're going to be used as a mulch on campus. So they're not going to waste.
And I'm sure that probably municipalities are going to take advantage of that.
Correct.
As well.
Yeah.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist, and Cindy Haynes. She's an associate professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join our conversation. We're going to take a quick break, then we'll be back to answering your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post a question on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Geron of Iowa State University Extension. And you can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up is Matt on the line from Perry. Hi, Matt.
Hi, guys.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, we're just trying to plan lining about 30 foot of sidewalk from the sidewalk to our front door with shrubs and then flowers. And a few people have recommended to me to use boxwoods, but we did have a couple of the plants, and in that early spring and then the subsequent frost, we lost all of them. Would you recommend trying boxwoods again, or is there another low-lying, maybe hardier shrub you recommend trying instead?
As far as boxwood, boy, I'm a little hesitant. They can look very, very nice. But on the other hand, if we have a open, exposed winter and it gets very cold, they're also susceptible to winter burn or winter damage. And sometimes the damage can be really quite severe. So for that reason, I'm a little bit hesitant. So I'd probably prefer something different. As far as an evergreen, you could plant something like the yew. It's very, very common. You can grow that in sun or shade. You can prune it very easily. It's very tolerant of that. It's very reliable in most cases. So that would be a possibility as far as a small evergreen, if you wanted a small evergreen plant.
Sure.
But like I said, the boxwoods, they can be a little finicky.
Okay. Is there anything that gives it, does that also give it kind of a formal appearance, much like a boxwood might?
Oh, you can, because you can actually prune the yews into formal hedges where you make them boxed or whatever you want to do. So, in fact, some of the great gardens of the world have pruned or sheared yews. They can look very, very attractive, very formal.
But if you want to keep this really small, look for a cultivar that's going to stay fairly small. So that, because yews can also get very large and be very upright. There's kind of spreading types. So look for a cultivar that kind of fits, that's small, that has that habit that you want to try and maintain. So it's a little less work for you.
Okay. And then in terms of maintaining them through the winter, Is there, what do you recommend for like an ice melt? Because it is a used path, an ice melter that would not be harmful to the yew or to the, you know, potentially any perennials you might put in there.
Mm-hmm. I think the key there would be just to use it prudently, not to overuse it. Okay. And you can mix it with some sand if you wish. But there, I think the key is just using it prudently. Basically use it to loosen the bond between the sidewalk and the actual ice or snow, and then scrape it off. Don't use it to actually melt the entire amount of material on the actual sidewalk. So if you do that, and then in the spring, what you could do is as soon as the ground thaws out, you can go out there in the spring with your hose and water the area very heavily, and you can kind of flush it out of the soil, the salt.
All right, Matt, thanks so much for your call. Next up, Sam is on the line in Dyersville. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I got a small fireplace in it, and I've been taking this ash and throwing it out in my yard on top of the snow and whatnot. And can you get too much of that on? Because my grass really took a hit there last summer. I don't know if it was from the drought or what, but can you get too much of that ash on there?
Well, wood ash basically doesn't contain much in the way of nutrients. There is a little bit of potash, a little bit of phosphate. It's mainly a liming material. And so if you dump a fairly large amount in a small area, it could raise the soil pH to a unhealthy level. So you typically don't want to put a large amount in a small area. But if you just go out with your wood ash and you uniformly apply it very lightly through the entire yard, no problem at all.
Okay. I got one other quick question, if I may. I got a hackberry tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, if I recall, you guys called them the galls, the little
pimple-looking
things that come on the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
This tree is just full of them, and it's a great tree. And I know it's not the right time of the year, but I need to get ready. So what do I spray on that to stop that?
I really don't think it's feasible or practical. You have to do it at a certain time, and you'd get only one shot right as the foliage was coming out in the spring. You'd have to spray the entire tree. In my mind, it's simply not practical. It's not. And you'd have to do it every year, too. So it'd be very difficult to do and very expensive, I think, to do it. So in my mind, it's not practical. But if you want to pursue that, you can check with Donald Lewis, our entomologist here at Iowa State, and see what he would suggest. His phone number is 515-294-1101. And you can discuss that with him. But I don't know of anybody that has done that because it's just very, very difficult to do.
And because hackberries get to be fairly large trees, it often requires a professional to apply an insecticide.
So impractical and expensive.
Impractical and expensive. You could just tell your neighbors that you have an unusual hackberry that, you know, that the insects love and that you're growing a new colony of certain insects on
but
it.
As far as the tree is concerned, even though it has these galls on it, it's not greatly impacted.
No.
The damage is mainly aesthetic. When we look at it, we think it doesn't look so good, and it doesn't. But as far as the tree is concerned, it's not a big deal.
Hackberries can take it. They're very tough trees.
Yep.
All right, Sam, thanks a lot for your call. Steve is on the line next in Oskaloosa. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is concerning the spruce trees that I'm currently cutting down to die this past year.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have, I see some more that have some branches that are starting to show the brown that have died on other ones. And I know that they've gone through a lot of stress these past 3 or 4 years with lots of rain and now with no rain. Is there any way to, I mean, do we start adding water and nutrients to the ground around them to try and get them to survive and make it through, or is my question?
I don't think that fertilization probably is going to help that much.
Okay.
And as far as watering, It all depends upon how many you have. I mean, if you have just a few, like 4 or 5, and we have a really dry summer, then I could see maybe trying to water those trees periodically for their benefit.
Okay.
But if you have like several hundred, obviously that's not practical. So
yeah, no, we probably had about 15 of them. We've lost 5 of them okay. now, and it's very disheartening.
Right. So since it's a manageable number, then yes, you can do that, and you could just go out there if the hose would reach, and just take the hose out there, and turn it on slowly. Place it around the outer edge of the canopy of the evergreen.
Okay.
And just go around the tree several times.
Okay.
And just let it soak in. So you can do it that way, or you can get a soaker hose and put it underneath and around the tree, so you can do that too.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I would also plant some more trees too.
In that direction, yes. I'm assuming this is stress related because there's really no disease hitting the spruce trees, correct, here in Iowa?
Not correct if they're Colorado spruce.
Go ahead.
Okay. The Colorado spruce is very susceptible to rhizosphere needle cast. It's very, very common. It slowly destroys the tree. The lower limbs die first, and then it gradually works upward. But it's very, very common, and it's very, very hard on the Colorado or blue spruce. So if it's one of those, then disease is very, very common. Norway spruce is relatively disease-free. And for the most part, they've been doing pretty good even in the last few years.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for your call. And next up, let's go to Jeff on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, what's your question?
My question is my wife brought in some plants from the outside, and we all of a sudden we got a
We seem to have lost Jeff. All right.
Uh-oh.
Call back, Jeff. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Let's go to Carol on the line in Ames. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I was wondering if anyone has any experience with these apple trees that are sold as single stem dwarf, maybe, but, you know, I have a lot of unusual things in my yard anyway, so something that might produce, even if I only got a small amount of fruit. And I said to my husband, you know, a lot of times these odd things are not the best tasting, but I was just wondering if anyone had any experience with them and what they'd have to say.
Could you be a little bit more specific?
So it's Miller's Nursery, and they actually, the fruit is just borne along the main trunk.
There are
no side branches.
Right. I have no experience with those. I've seen those for the last several mm-hmm. years in catalogs. They look interesting. I guess my question would be, would they be very productive? And how would they taste? And that I don't know. But I've seen them. It might be worth maybe planting one or two just to see how they perform. But to me, they're kind of an unknown yet. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I thought, too.
Yeah, we used to sell them in a nursery that I worked at, and they're very formal looking. They're often planted for this kind of formality and for the beautiful blooms. And they often only produce maybe 5 or 6 or 12 apples on, you know, each tree. So it's not an apple that you're planting, you know, for a lot of apples.
So it's more of an ornamental.
More of an ornamental than anything else. And I don't remember it tasting as being one of the most fantastic apples I've ever had either. But I don't remember it as being a really bad one either. So I think it's, like I said, more ornamental than it is an edible.
All right, Carol, thank you so much for your call. And Mary's on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a problem. I ordered this zosia grass because it said you wouldn't have to do much for maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And it has proliferated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to get rid of it.
Well, I don't have good news, really. It's very, very hard to get rid of. Very
it's
hard.
It's a good spreader.
It does spread. Mm-hmm. It's a southern type grass, more mm-hmm. suited to like Florida and Texas. If you wanted to kill it, mm-hmm. it's probably going to be a 1 or 2 year project. It's very, very hard. So what you would do is you would go out there like in early June mm-hmm. when the zoysia grass is nice and green, and you would spray it with Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, hopefully in 2 weeks, that zoysia grass would turn brown. And then you would take a sod cutter and remove that dead sod.
It's so and, deep.
And, well, you'd probably go down like 2 or 3 inches.
Oh, no, the roots go down.
I know they do.
Okay.
But you're going to remove the dead sod.
Okay.
Okay. And then you're going to wait. And the surviving roots will send up some new vegetation mm-hmm. within a few weeks. Then you're going to spray that with Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to keep on doing that for at least 1 year so that every time little growth comes up, you basically put on Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to do this at least a year, possibly two. And then if you're very persistent, then hopefully eventually it does die out and then you reestablish grass. But it's a long-term project, at least a year, one growing season at least,
mm-hmm.
possibly two. It's hard to kill. It's very, very persistent.
All right, Mary, thank you so much for your call, and good luck with that. Anne is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
So I have two rose bushes that are in places, you know, that can't be seen or anything. Mm-hmm. One is a hardy climbing rose. One is a David Austin rose, and I'd like to transplant them.
Okay. The best time probably to try that, and they can both be transplanted, is in late winter, early spring, maybe just before the buds are starting to swell. With the David Austin, you can do a little bit of, you know, tip pruning on that and dig up as large of a root ball as you possibly can and, you know, replant it and reestablish it as quickly as possible. The hardy climbing rose, because it's often a little bit larger, you may have to do some cutting back to make it a more manageable size. But once again, it's very movable as well. Both of these will do best if they're in full sun with a well-drained, fertile soil. They'll perform well for you. The first year after transplanting, they should bloom, but they may not bloom as much as they will in succeeding years after they've reestablished. So continue to water and maybe a little bit of fertilizer for each of these this year to kind of get them reestablished and then expect the better blooms next year or the year after.
All right, Anne, thank you for your call. And time for one last question. This is from Theo. Any reason to expect currently flowering orchids to flower again in the future? Indoor care requirements in Iowa to keep them thriving and able to flower again?
Oh, yes, you can. The Phalaenopsis orchis has the ability to flower at least twice indoors during a growing year. Keep them in good condition. Keep them well watered. They do require some regular fertilizer, especially after bloom. And some of these orchids do best when they have a little bit of a cooler night temperature. This is why some of the moth orchids will bloom in winter. So good care, good humidity, a little bit of fertilizer, and consistent light, and you might get lucky.
All right. Thank you so much, Cindy.
Thank you.
Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Monday at this time, we'll be carrying NPR's coverage of the second inauguration of President Barack Obama. This is Talk of Iowa.